With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Greetings, and you are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. Well, we're rolling up on the month of October, which means only one thing here at Savage Science Radio. Get ready for some spine-tingling chills. Settle in and get your teddy bear because it's time to get spooked.
Seven seas, ever.
Well, hello there, and welcome to Savage Science Radio. Now, we are doing our October rollout once again, and this is always something very fun because not only do I love to gross people out on a regular basis and freak them out on a semi-regular basis, I like to bring as much as I can of the old world radio and those wonderful suspense shows, sci-fi and horror, to you so that you can relive what people actually have in their psyches, which built on what we call horror genre today, or sci-fi even. And there are channels on television that deal with nothing but sci-fi and horror. It is a beloved genre, and why? Because we like to be scared, and we like to wonder what if. So I had originally brought you The Price of Fear, one episode, and I promised a little bit more in-depth information about this show, and here it is. Now, The Price of Fear will always be associated with more Vincent Price, the famous American actor and host of the series, than, of course, its BBC production history. The BBC's World Service first broadcast the initial order of 5 The Price of Fear episodes in the spring of 73, and that would be 1973. The initial 5 episodes aired consecutively Monday through Friday between July 2nd and July 6th, 73, of course, and then again between December 17th and December 21st of that same year. Now, the World Service broadcasts were so popular that BBC ordered another 5, which combined with the previous 5 episodes, apparently aired weekly on both Tuesdays and Saturdays from September 1st, 73 to November 6th, 73. Now, by 74 the next year, the BBC's Radio 4 had ordered another 6 installments of the series, now widely referred to as Season 2, which aired weekly from April 6th through May 11th of 74, of course. Now, remember that the BBC, a state-owned broadcasting service, traditionally prohibited any form of commercial messages or sponsorship. Any series that was extended or expanded was due only to listener support letters and phone calls to the service. The series that returned again and again over the BBC had only their listeners to thank for their longevity. The BBC's Radio 4 ordered another 6 installments in 1982, believe it or not, and Season 3, which aired weekly from May 30th, 83 through July 4th, 83, bringing the entire canon to a theoretical 22 installments over 10 years and 3 ostensible seasons, quote-unquote. Now, we say ostensible because the intent and actual air dates and order for the 1973 broadcasts are still somewhat ambiguous. We're just kind of relying on, you know, whatever information we can pick up on the internet. Now, The Price of Fear becomes a popular international favorite at this time, recorded in every corner of the world when first broadcast over their World Service, like I just said. Now, The Price of Fear soon became one of the most widely recorded offerings of its era. People would actually sit there and record with their cassette tapes. How cool is that, right? Remember those days? Well, some of you probably don't, but some of us that are old do. As with most BBC productions, the acting talent and production values were excellent throughout the whole entire grouping. Now, the stories dramatized in the series are from some of the supernatural fiction of the world's finest authors, of course. William Ingram was responsible for almost half of the stories and scripts, backed up by the works of Bram Stoker, Roald Dahl, Robert Arthur, Rene Basilico, Stanley Ellen, just tons of them. John Dyess produced and directed all 3 series over this 10-year period, by the way. Now, host Vincent Price, already long since recognized throughout the world as the reigning master of the macabre, virtually ensured that the series would be heard. True to his legend, Price's narration and his presence on the series provided a voice as chilling and familiar to the World Service listeners as that of their own Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing, to other names that cannot be separated from the genre. The Price of Fear has been picked up as an international favorite, like I said, ever since its very first airing. All they had to do was say who was involved, and boom, people were there. It was picked up by several shortwave and FM stations in the U.S. and enjoyed broadcast airings over several American public broadcasting stations from 1973 on. The BBC's proscription against commercial broadcasts of its productions left only national or public broadcasting networks and stations capable of airing the compelling program. Haha, there you go. We're always pushing our PBS because and our NPR because that's what we stand behind. And this is another one that is a fulcrum in promoting it. The former varied only slightly over its various run extensions, and it should be noted that in all extant recordings, the series is introduced as The Price of Fear, intentionally underscoring both the connection with Vincent Price himself and as well as the clever either the newsreader or Vincent Price himself would introduce the production. Price would provide a bit of personal exposition regarding the story to follow and would segue into the script. At the end of the script, Price would wrap up the piece in the same first-person manner and various BBC newsreaders would announce the credits depending on, you know, where they were aired or when they were aired, I should say. Vincent Price personalized every episode with either first-person asides or through the fictional artifice of portraying the story of the evening as having personal connection to his past, which made it extremely interesting because we're all, you know, very hungry for when we find someone who is that special to us. He really spoke to our psyche, and part of the reason why he popularized so much of the suspense and master of horror, Edgar Allan Poe. What was that about? What are you afraid of? Why are you afraid of it? Is it going to come and get you? Stay tuned, right? That's exactly the reason why. We all like that adrenaline rush, and that's part of the draw into this. And when you find someone who does it so well, like Vincent Price does, anything he does is a magnet for attention. Now, while it's clear that, you know, the personal connection was contrived for the series itself, there was just enough Vincent Price's own multidisciplinary past included in each expository narrative to make each episode all the more personally compelling for the listener. It was a brilliant stroke to interweave Price's own history of dramatic portrayals of the macabre in creating a more personal connection with the audience. The BBC itself shows only 16 programs available in its entire corporate catalog. All 16 of those programs in the BBC World Service catalog are in wide circulation. Of the additional 6 programs broadcast, only 4 are in current circulation. So you really have to go back and look for these things. The 20 circulating episodes of The Price of Fear were the golden age of radio revival at its finest and the equal of any radio revivals that have aired since. So sit back and enjoy an episode of The Price of Fear. It's called Come As You Are by William Ingram. When Vincent Price attends a party, a phantom encounter with a guest gives fancy dress a whole new meaning.
The Price of Fear, brought to you by Vincent Price.
My little story for this week, I want to call Come As You Are. You know that meaningless concession that gets added onto invitations to a party? You see, it's because the endless business of dressing up is such an integral part of my professional life that among my friends, my very positive reluctance to attend any kind of fancy dress party or costume ball is not only well established, but understandingly accepted. On a recent trip to London, I was genuinely delighted to find an invitation from my old friend Charles Vane awaiting my arrival. It wasn't until I'd reached that key and, to me, ominous phrase, fancy dress will be worn, that my heart sank. The fact that my would-be host had crossed it through and substituted the words, come as you are, afforded little by way of consolation. There can be few experiences so desultory as to find oneself sober-suited in the midst of a determined company of let's-pretend Casanovas, paunchy Tarzans, and moth-eaten King Kongs. As I put Charles's invitation back in its envelope, I'd already instinctively decided to decline. But even as I mailed my politely phrased refusal to his kind invitation, I had the distinct feeling that I was not to be let off the hook so lightly. The 2 a.m. phone call confirmed my misgivings. Hello.
Vincent, it's damn well not good enough, do you hear?
What? Oh, I'm sorry, who is that?
It's not only not good enough, I'm damn well not going to take no for an answer.
Charles, oh, Charles, is that you?
Surprise, surprise, of course it's Charles. If Mohammed won't go to the mountain needs must. Anyway, who the hell else did you expect it to be?
Well, believe it or not, old thing, there are alternatives. Parents, relatives, friends, acquaintances. Oh, you'd be surprised.
Oh, would I? Well, yeah. I just hope you're not in the habit of treating them in the same shoddy fashion, that's all.
Charles, delighted as I am to hear from you, you know it is the middle of the night.
Wrong again, Vincent. The early hours of the morning. But what's that got to do with anything?
Nothing. Nothing at all, except that we mere mortals do rather count on a certain quota of sleep.
Mere mortals bore me.
Oh, yes, it slipped my mind. Please forgive the lapse.
I'm forgiving you damn all. Are you still there?
Still here?
It's on account of that damn stupid fancy dress bit, isn't it? So why do you think I changed it to come as you are in the first place?
Out of the question. The intimacies of my sleeping attire must remain a closely guarded secret.
Don't be skittish. In a way, all I hope is you had sufficient sense to keep the damn thing.
The damn... what, the invitation?
Yes, of course the invitation is what you're keeping me from my beauty sleep about.
I'm keeping you!
Yes, well, on the back you'll find a simple set of directions for getting here. Oh. A child of 5 could manage it. I've marked the priory with a damn big cross in the top right-hand corner.
The priory?
The house, my house. You will love it.
Oh, yes, I'm sure I would, Charles. But as a matter of fact, I have another appointment. A scriptwriter friend of mine is coming...
To hell with all scribblers, I shall expect you at 8.
But, Charles, I honestly don't see how
will
I can...
Will you let me get some sleep, damn you?
Charles, are you there? Charles! Charles? Oh, blast. Put to the test, Charles's simple set of directions might well have been comprehensible to a 5-year-old child. But not having one of them with me in the passenger seat, I spent hours exploring the same piece of countryside in ever-decreasing circles. I was just on the point of returning to London when I spotted the entrance to his drive. And within minutes, I was standing in the hall of one of the most remarkably beautiful houses it has ever been my pleasure to enter. The party was obviously in full swing.
Ah, there you are. Let the festivities commence. Vincent, you're late, damn it.
Oh, Charles, how good to see you.
I've been ringing that ridiculous hotel of yours for the best part of the evening.
What?
Thought you'd gone and funked out at the last minute.
Oh, I am sorry about that. Your directions weren't as explicit as you cracked them up to be.
Huh?
As a matter of fact, as a cartographer, your talent seemed to be singularly lacking.
Nonsense. If Columbus had had me aboard, he'd have found the new world there one hell of a lot sooner than he did. Anyway, seeing as how you finally made it, come along into the library.
All right.
We'll fortify ourselves with a brandy or three before I introduce you to the somewhat dubious delights of the snake pit.
All right.
There you go, then.
Bye. Oh, I am sorry. Thank you.
Yeah, you're miles away.
Yes, I'm just taking it all in.
The house? Yeah, impressive, isn't it?
Beautiful, Charles.
Cost me a pretty packet, I can tell you.
Really beautiful.
Point taken. Yeah, you're quite right, of course. The heathen financier in me. Always been under the impression they amounted to much the same thing. Anyway, here's to it.
And to your health and to your house. Tell me about it.
The priory? Well, don't expect me to go into the full historic bit. But for all that, mentioned in the Domesday, one of the gems of early English monastic architecture, you know, the kind of thing.
Well, I'm more than prepared to believe it.
Yeah, the domestic conversions came later, but it's still pretty exceptional. Anyway, I first fell in love with the place about 5 years back when I was a guest here at a party.
Oh?
A rather bizarre junkyard given by the wife of the then owner.
Oh, I see.
Well, I think she realized I rather coveted the place from the word go. And last season we met up again in the south of France. She told me her lifestyle had changed somewhat since our last meeting, and judging by the bevy of young Apollo she had in tow, I was more than prepared to believe it. Well, I eventually got round to the house, and she said that providing the figure was right, the place was mine for the asking.
Well, it obviously was, then.
Let's just say the contract was concluded to the mutual satisfaction of both parties, shall we?
You're the same old Charles.
So, here we are, 9 months later, and it's housewarming night on the old corral.
Thank you. Are you thinking of settling here?
Nothing surer. Oh, you look skeptical.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
My eye.
Well, you do have something of a reputation to live down, you know.
Well, you must give me 5 marks for effort, at the very least. I've already got so far as settling into the place, even acquired a genuine English butler and a stable of splendid hunters. Yeah, every reason to be proud of my new country gentleman image, don't you think?
Well, all you need now is a genuine English rose to complete the picture.
I'm working on it.
You being serious?
I am. The question is she?
Oh, am I to meet her tonight?
Oh, my dear fellow, here tonight, her blue-blooded parents would have 40 blue-blooded fits.
Oh, then this is something of a last fling.
Let's just settle for the last but one, shall we?
All right, if you prefer.
I most certainly do. Right, let's be having you then. My lords, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the snake pit.
My original misgivings about accepting Charles's invitation proved well justified. Along with the disguises I'd anticipated, in a matter of minutes I'd been introduced to a somewhat bibulous archbishop, an emaciated Theda Barra on the decline, and the oldest bunny girl in the business. Charles's come-as-you-are concession proved a somewhat dubious advantage. My conventional business suit seemed to generate the same degree of cool hostility as if I'd elected to wear it at a convention of nudists. It was with a very positive feeling of relief that I eventually escaped the throng and sought out some corner strategically removed from the general merrymaking. The minstrel's gallery seemed perfect. Suitably fortified with a private bottle of Charles's excellent Dom Cliquot, I climbed to my remote perch as eagerly as any canary in its gilded cage, a positive refuge, where I could ponder the idiot antics of my fellow man and consider myself well out of it.
And so you are, old fellow, so you are. Well out of it.
In the gloom of the gallery, I'd almost stumbled over the man. I managed a rather startled apology, but even when my eyes had grown accustomed to the darkness, the details of his physical appearance remained extremely vague. The quality of his voice, the spare, angular outline of the silhouette he presented, suggested someone of middle age, but then he could just as well have been a great deal older. Only for the briefest of instants was I positively aware of his pale, watery eyes, opaque behind the glint of his old-fashioned pince-nez.
I hope I didn't startle you.
Well, somewhat, I must confess. I didn't realize I was intruding.
A temporary refuge from the madding crowd, eh?
Yes, I know it must seem ungracious.
Oh, to some it might. For my own part, well, given the option, I'd have been abed and asleep hours ago. Oh, won't you take a seat?
Oh, thank you so much. Allow me to introduce...
On these occasions, formal introductions always strike me as superfluous. On top of which, I can't offer my hand.
Oh?
A somewhat unfortunate accident.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. If I were to fetch another glass...
Oh, it doesn't agree with me. But why don't you?
Oh, thank you.
I'm glad to observe that one of us, at least, had the courage to refuse being bullied into dressing the part.
Fancy dress. As in some ways it might have been easier to oblige.
The proverbial sore thumb, eh?
Yes.
In my own case, well, there was little option.
Oh?
My wife, you know. Huh? She positively revels in this kind of revel. But Possibly you've already observed her. Hmm. Titania in all her glory.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes, as a matter of fact, I have.
It would be difficult not to.
Well, extremely effective.
Ridiculously pathetic.
What?
I can think of few sights so ludicrously tragic as a middle-aged siren aping the appearance and manners of a young girl half her age. Mm. Do I embarrass you?
Well, I...
Oh, you must forgive me, but her penchant for youth is so notorious, I now feel little reluctance to talk about it. Her companion this evening, for instance...
Oh, you mean the young man in the costume
you
of
have him.
Yeah.
Though the appurtenances of a gigolo might have been more appropriate.
Oh?
Her darling boy of the moment, Luigi del Potrello. The name means nothing to you?
Del Potrello. Oh, yes, it does sound familiar.
In most circles, it has a certain notoriety. Ah. The Potrellos are Italian merchants.
Oh, yes.
Extremely wealthy, hideously flamboyant, and totally without any distinction, taste, or breeding. Mm. Right from the outset, my home seemed in a perpetual state of siege. Billet-doux by every post, secret assignations, ridiculously extravagant floral arrangements. Uh-huh. And then the ultimate indignity of having the scoundrel pay court under my very roof. To be made constantly aware of their asinine sniggerings, their barely concealed whisperings, their grotesque fondlings, the middle-aged lovebird and her twittering young chick. But it wasn't until he started implanting his obscene influence on the house itself that my anger and frustration reached full spate.
How obscene.
Yes, obscene. Isn't it extraordinary how something as seemingly insignificant as a mirror can underline the absolute bathos of one's situation? Underline it with far greater emphasis than any of the indignities and infidelities that have gone before.
Well, I'm not sure that I understand. You did say a mirror?
Yes, one of his many gifts to her. A hideously ornate creation in the fashionable Florentine manner. You know the kind of thing. All gilt cupids, intricately entwined vine leaves.
Yes, I'm afraid I do.
Exactly, my dear fellow. Needless to say, quite out of keeping with the sober antiquity of my own furnishings... But a token of regard from her own darling boy, don't you see? And as such, to be blatantly hung in a place of honor. It seemed suddenly as if he were trying to destroy the very fabric of our lives.
Would it be impertinent of me to inquire?
What happened?
Yes.
No, but why not? It's probably common knowledge. The inevitable scene is the phrase that most readily springs to mind. But somehow, more significant than anything that had gone before.
Oh, you're exaggerating as usual.
I honestly don't think you realize
the gravity of the situation. Oh, come on, darling, say it. You can always be relied upon to trot out the obvious on these tedious occasions, can't you, my pet?
The occasion, as you choose to call it, might be a good deal graver than you think.
Now you're beginning to sound much more like the old dodderer you really are. Well, come on, darling, don't stop now. It's the well-known visit to the headmaster you had in mind, isn't it? If so, you are achieving it to perfection. The darling boy really has excelled himself this time, hasn't he? Such an appropriate gift. A direct invitation to see yourself as you really are.
So why the hell don't you tell your darling boy he can take his bloody mirror right back where it came from?
We'll have to see, won't we, my pet?
And was the mirror taken back?
I presumed it must have been. I certainly don't recall seeing the damn thing again. But then, quite suddenly, we both had more important things on our minds.
Oh?
I'd spent the day at the British Museum doing some research. I got home to find my wife had been taken seriously ill. In effect, a minor heart attack. Oh. I could only conclude it was a direct result of trying to keep up with her dissolute gadfly. Mm. The doctor advised that complete rest was absolutely essential. He also emphasized that there must be no undue excitement or shock. Yes, he particularly stressed the last bit, awe, shock. Mm. Even as he said it, it sounded strangely significant.
Why significant?
Well, as it turned out, I had stayed up reading very late one night. I must have dozed off, because I was suddenly startled awake by a noise. It came from the head of the stairs.
What kind of a noise?
Difficult to describe, but a sort of bump, I suppose. Mm. A slight trip, perhaps. The servants had retired hours before. There was only my wife. At least, I believed that to be the case. Until I heard their voices coming from my wife's bedroom. I recognized Luigi's laughter immediately. Then, after a while, there was only silence. I think that silence was the most difficult thing to bear of all. For the first time, I admitted to myself that I had lost my wife to Luigi forever.
And your reaction?
How can one describe? Resignation, love, jealousy, hate,
yes.
All at the same time. I wanted her dead.
What?
I needed her dead. But had no notion how I could achieve it. I'm not a courageous man, not even an artful man. I returned to the study. And there, I saw something that seemed to suggest the perfect solution.
Yes, go on.
Shortly before her illness, I'd drawn my wife's attention to a book dealing with the medieval history of the house.
Yes. Well,
needless to say, she discarded it halfway through. But there was one particular section that not only claimed her interest, but held it in a state of shocked disbelief I'd never witnessed before. It concerned a ghost.
A ghost?
Most historic homes seem to lay claim to one. Knowing my wife's somewhat nervous disposition, I'd previously kept ours something of a closely guarded secret. But now, no undue excitement or shock was what the doctor had said. There and then, I determined my ghostly inhabitant should serve his turn.
Well, what kind of a ghost?
The ghost of a Franciscan friar. Oh, the costume wasn't too difficult to improvise. A burnous, one of those Arab nightdress affairs, complete with hood, served my purpose to perfection. I put it on, lit a candle, left my study. I crossed the hall. The stairs creaked as I began to climb. I didn't mind. It only added to the theatricality of the scene I was about to enact. I could already imagine slowly opening the door of my wife's bedroom, hear her call out, "Who's there?" See the expression on her face as she watched in terror the specter of the Franciscan friar loom towards her. Perhaps one brief, terrified scream. And then I just reached the top of the stairs, was about to cross the landing, when I saw it. The actual specter there, confronting me. The face shrouded in its hood, the candle flickering in its hand. The eyes, deeply socketed, stared accusingly into mine. For a long moment, there was only disbelief at what I saw. And then, panic. I tried to move, but couldn't. I tried to scream out, but no voice came. Then, with a newfound volition of its own, my arm lashed out with the heavy brass candlestick I was holding, lashed out at the ghastliness of that grizzled face. God help me. In the name of Christ, somebody help me.
For God's sake, man.
Oh, my God, Charles. Charles.
What the devil do you mean by slinking off like that?
I'm sorry.
Well?
I turned towards my distraught storyteller, but he was gone. Probably realizing he was in imminent danger of being forced back into the swinging multitude below.
Oh, come along, man. Don't just hang around in the gloom. There's somebody special I want you to meet.
From the far end of the library, Titania herself confronted me. She sat there enthroned in one of Charles's splendid high-backed chairs.
Captain of our fairy band, mortals, darlings, close at hand.
As she misquoted from the bard, Titania made very short work of a very large brandy. In view of my so recent conversation with her husband, I must have looked somewhat taken aback. She was not slow to notice the fact.
Something worrying you, darling.
Well,
Charles, be a dear. Titania's running low on nectar. Well, darling, you were saying...
I do apologize. It's pure coincidence, of course, but I've had the pleasure of making your husband's acquaintance.
My husband?
Yes.
You did say my husband?
Yes.
Oh, damn you, Charles. You haven't gone and told every Tom, Dick, and Harry my little secret. You know I particularly asked you to keep it strictly entre nous. Luigi would be furious.
Luigi? But that isn't your husband.
Oh, what a damn fool I am. Now I've gone and let the cat out of the bag. You must have been referring to that dreadful old dodderer I was imbecile enough to spend the best years of my life with.
Now, darling, we mustn't speak ill of the dead.
The dead?
Thank God. The best part of 2 years, isn't it, Charles? Even at the very end, the old dodderer proved as parsimonious and mean-minded as he'd been all along. Still, he paid for it. One of the few comforting things in life is that one can always depend on getting exactly what one deserves.
Or deserving exactly what one gets.
Oh, Charles, darling, you are being cynical. Anyway, I must away. Luigi has gone missing, don't you know? It isn't that I don't trust the darling boy, darling. It's simply that I don't. Goodbye, Mr.
Goodbye.
Charles, darling. Oh, it's been bliss. But Titania, darlings, must away to live and fight another day.
What the hell was all that about?
Charles, tell me about him, her late husband.
Edward.
Was that his name?
Well, I only met the old stick once, and then very briefly, on my first visit to the place.
This place?
Well, of course, this was his house. He died here.
Where? Where exactly did he die?
You know, you look really peaky.
Answer the question, for God's sake. Please, Charles.
Well, as a matter of fact, at the head of the stairs.
The stairs leading to the minstrel's gallery?
Yes.
And the circumstances?
Oh, a bit unusual, really. It was Helen who found him. Apparently the old fool was on his way to bed, or got up in this ridiculous dressing gown thing of his, when he spots this mirror.
The mirror? At the head of the stairs? It was Luigi's mirror, wasn't it?
Oh, has darling boy been telling you all about that?
Wasn't it?
Yes, a gift to Helen. The old boy raised such a stink about it, she locked it away at the back of a cupboard. Anyway, one night, after a somewhat torrid meeting with her darling boy, Luigi raises Cain and insists on hanging it out in the open.
Directly at the top of the stairs, so that anyone coming up them would be bound to see his own reflection, wouldn't he?
Which is exactly what happened. Edward spots it, loses his temper, and smashes the thing to smithereens. Yeah, it was that caused the heart attack, of course. Not to mention his hand.
What about his hand?
Well, severed. Quite severed. Extraordinary the violence that can be generated through a fit of jealousy, isn't it? I wish you'd have another brandy.
Will you tell me what he looked like, Charles?
Oh, Edward. Oh, do even better.
Charles handed me a snapshot. It was faded, but I spotted him immediately. One face among many, but I'd have recognized it anywhere. Not because of any particular feature, but because there, staring out at me, were the same pale, watery eyes, opaque behind the glint of his old-fashioned pince-nez. I handed the photograph back.
Thanks. But might as well get rid of it.
Oh.
Not much point dwelling on the dead, is there?
No. Not much. Charles invited me to stay the night. I automatically refused. Some weeks later, he suggested we meet up again before he left on a business trip to the continent. The Priory was again suggested as a rendezvous. But in view of what had gone before, at the very last minute, I switched it to my hotel dining room instead. The decor hideously modern, the food bad, the waiters rude, the place positively bulging with people. I wouldn't have had it any other way.
That was Vincent Price, bringing you The Price of Fear. Co-starring in Come As You Are was Maurice Perry, with Betty Huntley Wright and Peter Williams. Come As You Are was first recounted and dramatized by Bill Ingram and produced by John Dyers.
And I'd like to also add a little bit about William Ingram, the author of this particular play, writer-actor. William Ingram lives in South Wales. He's probably one of the most prolific and successful writers of radio drama, with some 400 plays to his credit. He's no stranger, of course, to the writing in the horror genre, which we just found out, of course, in his wildly popular BBC series, The Price of Fear. So, if you want to look him up, you can go to www.suttonelms.org.uk /bingram.html, and you can get links to a lot of his work. In fact, it might actually be all of his public work that were done in radio plays. And keeping in the mood of weird science, because that's all we're going to have for the next month, get prepared. Here's some weird science facts that you probably didn't know, or if you did know them, you didn't know all of them, so I'm going to bring them to you right now. Animals raining from the sky? Well, remember that was in an X-Files episode? Well, that came from reality. Raining animals is a relatively common meteorological phenomenon, with occurrences reported from many countries throughout history. You can imagine what they must have thought a few hundred years ago when they didn't have an explanation for this. People running around, you know, with their superstitions. The animals most likely to drop from the sky in a rainfall are fish and frogs, with birds coming in third. Sometimes the animals survive the fall, especially the fish, suggesting a small time gap between the extraction and the actual drop. Several witnesses of raining frogs describe the animals as startled, although healthy, and exhibiting relatively normal behavior shortly after the event. In some incidents, however, the animals are frozen to death or completely enclosed in blocks of ice. That would be fun to see, right? Ice blocks with fish in them. These occurrences may be evidence for the transport of victims to high altitudes where the temperature is, of course, below zero, and they show how powerful meteorological forces can be. Most recent occurrences in the rain of frogs and toads is in Serbia in 2005, London in 1998, and rains of fish in India 2006, and Wales in 2004. In the Honduras, the rain of fishes that they have, that's what they call it, is a unique phenomenon that has been occurring for more than a century on a yearly basis in the country of course, as we said, Honduras. It occurs in the Departamento de Oro between the months of May and July. Witnesses of this phenomenon state that there's a dark cloud in the sky, followed by lightning, thunder, strong winds, and heavy rain for 2 to 3 hours. Once the rain has stopped, hundreds of living fish are found on the ground. People take the fish home to cook and eat them. Of course, what are you supposed to do with them? Although some experts have tried to explain the rain of fishes as a natural meteorological phenomenon, the fish are not seawater fish, but they're freshwater fish, and they're not dead, they're alive, they're not blind, they have eyes, they're not big fish, they're small, and the type of fish is not found elsewhere in the whole area. There's no valid scientific explanation for this phenomenon, believe it or not. Yeah, but they're looking for one. You betcha. Many people believe this phenomenon occurs because Father Jose Manuel Sabriana, a Spanish Catholic missionary and considered by many to be a saint. He visited Honduras from 1856 to 1864, and upon encountering so many poor people, he prayed for 3 days and three nights, asking God for a miracle to help the poor people by providing food, and the rain of fishes has occurred ever since. So, of course, the scientists are all in there, and the biologist and a meteorologist trying to figure out exactly what causes this crazy thing that happens every year. Interesting. I was going to look for some video of it, and I wasn't able to find it, but I think I probably have to translate it to Spanish and then look for it that way. And if I do, I'll tell you about it next week. How's that sound? This brings Savage Science to a close this week. Creepy stories just for you. Why? Because we care. We care about the scare. I'd like to thank Nick Palucco for the great show graphics, Dennis Bond and Hot Productions for that fantastic intro I use every week. Get us ready and revved up for the show. Waleed Al-Haddad, who helps me find these really crazy and great stories to bring to you, and Todd Sheets, my executive producer, magic man behind the technical aspect of the show. So, until next week, keep your powder and your pants dry, and happy trails to you.
I'm out of pockets, it's almost Halloween. All my friends are wondering what they're gonna be. The monster mash is playing, you're moving to the beat. And now we're gonna teach you the trick or treat.
Everybody scream, everybody scream, it's almost Halloween. Do the trick or treat, do the trick or treat, it's almost Halloween. Everybody scream.
There's a devil in the corner and candy dressed up like a fire, burning through my head. I got a little closer and offered her a drink. She took me to the graveyard and we did the trick or treat.
Everybody scream, everybody scream, it's only Halloween. Do the trick or treat, do the trick or treat, it's only
when I woke up in my coffin, she was nowhere to be seen. Was it all a dream? Who can I believe? It can't be what it seems. It was only Halloween. What does it all mean?
Only Halloween, everybody scream.
Notes from her snow white flow, fill a space in which two bodies float.